Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard across the state on UPR, that's Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, polling shows that Utahns are divided when it comes to understanding the reason President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Also, a candidate for Democratic Party chair ends his campaign amid sexual harassment allegations. A stalemate over funding for a tracks line extension at the airport, and the campaign to increase education funding in Utah officially gets underway. And joining us for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Hello, Dan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Also, government reporter Matthew Piper is with us as well. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh joins us in studio as well. Good morning to you, Paul. Welcome.
Good morning.
We also want to hear from you during this Friday morning news wrap-up. You can weigh in on the stories that we're covering today and post your questions as well at sltrib.com or on the KCPW Facebook page. You can also call us. We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, yesterday, former FBI Director James Comey appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee to give testimony. And he said, essentially, in plain English, that President Trump fired me because of the Russia investigation. But a poll that came out just a couple of days ago shows that Utahns are divided over the reason that Comey was fired. They have a different understanding than the FBI director himself, or they're split on this. Tell us about this this poll.
Yeah, so the poll that Dan Jones did for Utah Policy showed that slightly more Utahns, I think it was like 49%, said that they believed that the president fired Comey because he was doing a bad job. And just a little bit under that said, no, that he fired Comey because he wanted to derail this investigation into the Russia meddling in the election and connections with the Trump team.
That understanding, I mean, the discrepancy, it's more than just a simple discrepancy, because it could mean the difference between a public understanding of whether or not justice was obstructed or not.
Well, and I think it reflects the partisan view nationally. Nationally, polls show that actually about 6 out of 10 Americans, and this was before the testimony yesterday, but about 6 out of 10 Americans say that, yes, the president fired Comey because of the Russia investigation. And nationally, as well as very much locally, it's a partisan split. So you saw Republicans believing the president's viewpoint and view of the world, Democrats and independents saying, no, it's clear that the president did this because of the Russia investigation.
Well, the president hasn't been exactly consistent in explaining his reasoning, though he did in an interview with NBC's Lester Holt say that he had the Russia investigation in mind when he fired Comey.
Yes.
This might be more of a question for a legal scholar, but the obstruction of justice that is alleged to have occurred during Senate questioning yesterday, there was a lot of focus on the request that Comey says the president made for the FBI to drop its investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Trump also, as we just pointed out, suggested that he fired Comey because of the Russia investigation, the ongoing investigation into Russian election interference and potential ties with the Trump presidential campaign and Russia. Is one of those a more egregious example of obstruction of justice?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. You should ask a legal scholar, and I'm certainly not one of those. You know, Comey also said the president lied, and what he was talking about was the reason why he fired James Comey. And the original reason was he was doing a bad job, he'd lost confidence of the rank and file, and that's what Comey was saying that the president lied about. So that kind of strengthens, you know, I think the legal argument there. The trouble in this case is, you know, an impeachment of a president, which is how you'd prosecute this, is would be through the House of Representatives to begin with. And the House of Representatives is controlled by the Republicans. It, from every, you know, indication we're getting now, the House of Representatives is not close to even starting to talk about impeachment of the president.
Right.
For the most part, they're standing behind him. We saw Jason Chaffetz, who's, you know, on his way out the door, so he could really say anything he wants to.
But he said,
"Oh, this was a good day for the White House. This helped the president more than hurt him."
Well, he sees vindication, and again, this is kind of maybe on party lines. And I noticed this in questioning too, that the line of questioning seemed to be about building the case, you know, against the president if you were a Democrat, and building and trying to tear down that case against the president if you were on the Republican side of the aisle. Paul Rawley, from the opinion desk, did you watch Comey's testimony yesterday?
Parts of it. I was working, and so
I dipped into it.
We had the TVs going on in the newsroom, and I didn't see most of it, but I saw enough to get a flavor.
What are we? I mean, I guess a simple question is: what are we seeing happening right now? Is this the unraveling of a presidency, or is it not?
Well, to Dan's point, it's a Republican House, and the partisanship is so deep these days, and so split. Talking about Jason Chaffetz, he may be still auditioning for a job with Fox, because he has been about as partisan in his positions, especially when he was as chairman of the Oversight Committee, as anyone. So I wouldn't say we're seeing any kind of path to impeachment yet, because the poll showed, in Utah, and then nationally, how it split across party lines. You know, the Trump's base is still there, and the House, they're going to be up for re-election, and the safest districts in the House are basically Trump districts where Trump's base is strong, through the gerrymandering or whatever. So they have to take the risk of making Trump supporters mad, which was their base in their district. So, I think we've got a long way to go before we start talking impeachment.
So sticking with the president, maybe partially because of political calculus, I want to get listeners, comments on this, and feel free to call us. You're invited to join this conversation. We are at 801-355-8255. You can comment at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Paul, how about this Utah policy poll? I mean, you mentioned that it shows this split, but I'm wondering if what it shows is that people are unclear about the reason that Trump fired Comey. I'm wondering if today, if we looked at that same question today, a day after this testimony from Comey, if those numbers would have shifted.
Well, that's a good question. What it tells me is 45% of the Utahns are going to stick with Trump no matter what. And what's interesting is before he secured the nomination, he was not popular in Utah at all. They were very opposed to Trump. But once he got the nomination and once he became the Republican brand, they jumped in line, and I think you're going to see polls like that backing Trump at least 45%, 45 to 50% all the way along because of the partisan nature of everything that's going on right now.
Well, and I think in approval ratings, he still the president holds a very high or relatively high approval rating among Republicans, if I'm not mistaken.
Among Republicans, yes. Again, it's about 45% of the Utah public.
Okay. Well, there's a special counsel who's looking into all of this, another former FBI director, Robert Mueller, and we will see what he comes up with. We could pick this apart for the entire hour, but I think we should move on and maybe turn to some local politics stories. And one of those has to do with the race for Democratic Party chair. There have been allegations levied against one of the candidates in that race, actually one of the former candidates now. I should say this is Rob Miller. Dan Harry, first off, what were these allegations and who was making them?
Well, the allegations were made by seven women who are very well-known Democratic activists. They included a former Salt Lake County chairwoman for the party. They included a spokeswoman for the House Democrats and others that are, very well-known and established within the party. And the allegations were that a number of sexual misconduct and sexual harassment claims, unwanted kissing, unwanted touching, comments, and assorted things. And Rob Miller denied all of those and said, he was the target of a a political attack, a smear campaign, to in the effort to derail his campaign for chairman.
Well, I'd like to turn to what's happened over the past couple of days. There was a candidate forum that Miller appeared at, along with other people vying for this for the chairmanship of the Democratic Party in Utah. And this was on Wednesday. There was a protest of him.
Yeah, go and, ahead, Matt.
Yeah, Matt Piper covered this actually, and Matt Piper, government reporter. What happened at this protest or at this candidate forum? I guess.
Yeah, and so I wasn't there, but apparently every time he spoke, up to half the crowd stood up and turned its back to him. Scott Howell was moderating that, a former U.S. Senate candidate, and threatened to remove those people. But Rob Miller apparently said, let them stay. And before he walked out of the forum, he said that he planned to deliver his five-minute speech at the convention on June 17th. Later that night, or early Thursday morning, depending on how you look at it, he posted on Facebook that he had changed his mind. He would drop out of the race and leave the party altogether, and he followed up apparently with that on Thursday.
Okay, leaving the party as well, not just leaving this race, but I'm being done with the Democratic Party. Miller kind of called this a conspiracy against him. I mean, his response to the allegations of sexual harassment by these women, by seven women, was that this was a conspiracy to undo him politically.
Yeah, he said he's not perfect. He said that he may have said something along the lines of you're sexy to uplift a woman with low self-esteem. One of the allegations, at least, that he invited a woman to coffee on a professional basis and then asked her out. He admits to that, although he takes issue with some of the details of that account. But all the others he denies. He says that the number of allegations is sort of proof that this is a very well-organized conspiracy against him. And that was what motivated him. Well, that and the what he feels is a lack of due process is what motivated him to leave the party altogether.
Okay. Dan, what has the if they have said anything, what has the State Democratic Party said about Miller and the accusations against
him?
Well,
the party hasn't said anything. Peter Caroon has been, unreachable throughout this. They issued, I think, a one-line statement the first day, but they have just refused to comment on it altogether. And, that leaves a vacuum of information. They held this Judiciary Committee hearing. It was behind closed doors. We don't know what happened there. We don't know if it's going to continue. We don't know if Rob Miller's withdrawal from the race has ended that. We don't know anything because the party's not talking. And, as in all such cases, journalists are frustrated when that happens.
Either Dan Harry or Matt Piper, Miller for a time had been the favorite sort of candidate in this race for some period of time. I don't know if that's true, but do we know who it is now, who's sort of at that point?
We haven't been following the inner politics of the party that well, so I'm not sure who the front runner is right now.
I do have a little bit of an update. Sure. I guess this morning the letter writers wrote a second letter to the party. They actually sent it last night, but we just saw it this morning, in which they ask that the Judiciary Committee continue its investigation or release its findings because they see this as part of a larger problem within the party, part of a what they say is a pervasive culture of sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And they hope that something can be done to prevent this sort of thing from happening again.
In the meantime, you have a party that's a very small party in the state of Utah, and this infighting has caused a really what I think is probably going to be a long-lasting feud among its loyal members. And, that's just not a good thing. It's there's not enough Democrats really to fracture like this and still carry on as a legitimate, viable party.
One of a couple of feuds within that party, it would seem. Paul Raleigh, opinion columnist, do you want to weigh in on this at all? I mean, what might this mean for Utah Democrats?
Well, I've known Rob Miller for a long time. He sees himself as he's got kind of a different personality, kind of passionate. He gets real animated and gets in discussions on Facebook all the time and everything else. He sees himself as a child of the Democratic Party. His father, Mike Miller, was the top aide in Governor Calvin Rampton's administration back in the 60s and 70s, and Mike Miller was a real big deal in the Democratic Party. He was chairman at one point of the party back in the days when there actually was a Democratic Party in Utah. And Rob Miller has always seen himself as a protege of that. And so I think he probably sincerely believes he didn't do anything wrong. Mm. I think he's wrong. You know, he's got to come up with this conspiracy thing to justify it and everything else. But I know many of the women also who signed that letter. And they're people of great integrity. And so I think that their concerns are legitimate. And this could be a teachable moment. Mm. You know, there are still people who don't understand protocol, don't understand certain, behaviors might be across the line. You don't stroke a woman's hair unsolicited. You don't put your hand on somebody's thigh. You don't invite someone along on the pretense that you might hire them for a job and then ask them out on a date. Those are things you just don't do, but there are some people who still don't understand that. I've covered sexual harassment cases and complaints over the years, for years and years. And, you know, back in the 70s, you know, his behavior, his alleged behavior, I should say, mm-hmm. Was real common. And people, you know, didn't see anything wrong with that at all. And it's taken, you know, it's taken a few decades till we've gotten to this point where that is really unacceptable in society. And people are still, learning that lesson.
Well, and these women, one of their points was it's still common.
Right.
And, in most times it's just not brought to anyone's attention. And so they're saying, look, this happened. We know this happened to in many cases. And so we want to finally bring it out in the open because they said it had been known, you know, individually by many individuals separately, but not publicly for a long time.
Well, we'll see if the party continues to look at it. Hey, just we do have to go to a break, but before we do go to break, Dan, you mentioned actually current Democratic Party Chair Peter Caroon and not being reachable, but I'm kind of wondering what's happening with him. He's been the party chair. Is he retiring? Is he running for something?
Yeah, okay. He's retiring.
All right, that answers that question. We do need to head to a first break, but listeners, stay with us. There is more to come on the program. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Education reporter Ben Wood joins us as well. Good morning, Ben, by the way.
Good morning. Glad I can make it.
Government reporter Matt Piper and Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh. We are discussing this past week's local news, and you were invited to join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. And okay, so we did politics at the outset. Let's shift gears a bit and turn to Ben Wood, who's an education reporter. You wrote this week about the effort by Our Schools Now. Officially, Our Schools Now is launching their effort to raise $700 million for education in the state. The details of their proposal have kind of changed. Maybe you can tell us again about this effort and how it's being pursued, what route they're taking to pursue this.
Yeah, so they filed formally with the elections office this week, and when they announced their intent in November, they talked about a 7/8 of 1% income tax increase. That was met with mixed reviews from, you know, people around the state. And so now that they've filed, they're looking at a 0.5% income tax hike and a 0.5% sales tax hike, and that would be phased in over 3 years. So 0.2, 0.2, 0.1. on both sales and income
over a three-year period. Okay, so there's two parts of this, income tax and sales tax. Am I right that the sales tax component, if this proposal does advance, would need legislative approval? Does that make sense?
Not necessarily approval, but the legislature would be tasked with distributing that money. Okay. Whereas the income tax, it automatically funds the education fund. It it, you know, by constitutional decree, it goes towards schools. Sales tax, not so much the case. It goes into the general fund, and so lawmakers would have to direct that money towards schools in some fashion.
Okay. Can the crafters of the initiative, the ballot initiative, kind of guide that a little bit for the lawmakers? Is that part of this?
They can. The initiative itself talks about restricted accounts and reserved accounts, but in all practical terms, when you're talking about legislative appropriations, money is money, and it will be up to lawmakers. So there, that, you know, when I talked to Bob Marquardt, one of the chairmen, he talked about the power of public opinion, where if Utah votes to approve this and send this money to schools, he and our schools now believes that it would be tough for lawmakers to turn around and say, no, we're going to send this to UDOT. We're going to send this to other areas.
Got it. Okay, sort of mandate. Ben, who is our schools now? They are business leaders for the most part. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about Scott Anderson of Zions Bank, Gail Miller of the Miller Group, Ron Gibson, former Questar CEO. And so what you have members of the Salt Lake Chamber, the chambers throughout the state, prominent business leaders, and they're also bringing in former Teachers of the Year, the UEA, school boards associations. So it's a collection of notable business leaders and notable education folk.
The proposal that they have put together and tweaked and now are officially launching, it's met with some criticism from anti-tax groups, for one, and that probably was not something that was unexpected.
Sure. I mean, anytime there's talk of a tax increase, you would expect tax opponents to oppose. And the kind of prevailing sentiment from that side is that the initiative lacks specificity, that it's a blank check to schools and with no guarantee of results. And, of course, our schools now counters that. You know, you need local flexibility because the needs in St. George are different than the needs in Salt Lake City, and this would allow local administrators to prioritize. But that's kind of where the criticism is coming from, that it's just a dump of money into schools with no particular requirements of where it goes.
Some lawmakers also have expressed concern over this initiative, or at least they have expressed in the past concern about this previously.
Yeah, I mean, during the session, there was a lot of talk about tax adjustments. The lawmakers were looking at a sales tax, revenue neutral, kind of shoring up the food tax and decreasing the rate. It fell apart, but generally they've been looking at declining sales tax revenues and they see a need there. Income tax, however, they're pretty loath to mess with. They see our low income tax rate as a boon to business and economic development. They see healthy growth there. And so there is some apprehension about, well, raising taxes in general, but especially the income tax.
Okay. And so the initiative by our schools now is they want to get this ballot initiative, and by doing that, they have to gather signatures to do this. How are they doing that, and how soon can we expect to see, people going around with clipboards or however it's done? Can they gather electronic signatures?
I would have to defer to Dan Harry on that point. I'm not as versed in the initiative process, but they plan to begin collecting signatures in August.
Yeah.
So the month of July will be a public open house campaign throughout the state with various meetings, and then in August you'll see the clipboards going down the street.
People asking for it. Dan, do you know if they can do electronic signature gathering for a ballot initiative in Utah? I can't remember myself.
I'm trying to remember how that shook out. I don't think that they can do electronic signature gathering.
My impression is that they cannot. If I remember correctly, it's paper, ink, and pen.
Okay, well maybe some enterprising listener will call us at 801-355-8255 with the details there. But you can also call us with your questions and comments about the stories we are covering today. Again, it's 801-355-TALK. We've heard a lot over the years about Utah being among the lowest, if not the lowest, when it comes to per pupil spending. How far up that list would we move if we did do this spending increase?
Optimistically, we'd move up one slot from 50th to 49th.
Okay.
And that, there's a lot of caveats there, because this would not take effect until 2019, and it would be that gradual phase-in. So if no other state does anything over the next 5 years, then we might make 49th. But it wouldn't take too much by Idaho to stake their claim on that 49th slot and keep us in 50th.
Okay. Paul Rawley, the fear from lawmakers here sales tax increase is that this could cool off Utah's economy. The anti-tax groups say that this is kind of a misguided proposal. We shouldn't raise taxes. We are, though, again, the 50th in the state for education funding. What say you, Paul Rawley?
Well, you know, as Ben said, there's always resistance here, and especially in the legislature, among those guys against tax increases and that sort of thing. When they when this group tried this before, you know, they got a lot of resistance, and there was a and most legislators really you know, railed against it and said that it was misleading, that it was actually really a 19% tax increase and income tax increase. And before, it was all income tax. And I think what they're trying to do now is appease some of these groups and appease people in the legislature by sharing it with the sales tax.
Right.
But our colleague Robert Gerke had a really interesting column the other day about this, and talked about how they shouldn't even mess with the sales tax. It's a regressive tax. It's going to hurt low-income people. You know, this is just another appeasement. I think that they I think they're going to have a hard time again this time. They're going to get a lot of resistance, but you know, I think they're better off going. You know, and Robert talked about having an incremental, you know, keeping in the income tax and having incremental tax increases based on income, where you know, the higher income people pay more taxes. Although that's always been an unpopular idea among you know, the Republicans and conservatives here in Utah.
Well, you can imagine an effort being mounted to defeat the ballot proposition, assuming that it gets there. And you know, Ben, kind of a funny spot to put a reporter in, but any bets on whether A, this thing will make the ballot, and B, you know, that it will succeed on the ballot? I guess that's not your job.
No, but what I would say is, if there were to be a group of Utahns who could get something like this to the ballot, it's this group of Utahns. I mean, these are powerful, influential, deep-pocketed people, and so if anyone has a shot at getting a citizen initiative on the ballot, Our Schools Now is pretty looking competitive, we'll say.
Paul Raleigh mentioned the column by Robert Gerke, and actually it's a question for you, Ben, the sales tax was kind of an appeasement. The idea of including the sales tax was maybe an appeasement to those who would be very critical of this and try and defeat it once it did get to the ballot. Is that what this was, you know, actually about? Was trying to appease camps that were critical of this?
Yeah, speaking with the chairmans, I asked that question. They talked about how adding the sales tax element was the result of feedback. They didn't go more specific than there, but like Raleigh said, looking at the context of the atmosphere we live in, it does sound like this was a reaction to some legislative desire.
Okay, Dan Harry?
I think that, but I'd also speculate, I don't know this for a fact, but my guess is that they've done some polling, and the polling on the previous iteration of this, where they were going to raise, what, 7/8% on the rate, which would be a, what, 20%?
Yeah, just shy of 20.
Almost 20% increase in income tax. I think they probably did some polling on that, and they found that was probably a bit too steep, so they wanted to back off.
Okay.
These are smart folks. I mean, they're not just throwing this together. They're doing this in a very strategic way, I think.
Okay. Well, we have a listener on the phone who has a question related to this. This is Al from Centerville. Al, welcome. What's your question? Hello.
Well, since the income tax in Utah goes directly to education, why don't we limit the number of dependents to 2 on the income tax? That way people with more kids do pay a little bit more. I mean, it's not a ton more, but they pay a little bit more while they have kids in school.
Great question there, Alan. I will throw it to Ben Wood, education reporter. Maybe is that a proposal that would gain traction here in Utah?
Traction, no, but it is a very popular idea, especially among the sltrib.com comment section. You know, whenever there's talk of income tax increases, there is this refrain of, by limiting deductions, then you have the families with the most number of children in schools are no longer paying less to support schools. But, you know, in talking with lawmakers over the years, you know, Senator Pat Jones had looked at doing something like that. It never went anywhere. It's not likely to happen anytime soon.
Paul Raleigh?
That idea has always been dead on arrival of the legislature. I would get, you know, if you look at the makeup of the legislature, they're very different than the people who on SL Trib.com, I think. But they are, I would hazard to guess that the average legislator has five or six kids, you know, just looking at the makeup of that legislature. And so you're going to have, it's a tough sale again with those guys.
Against their own interests.
You know, yeah.
Dan Harry.
Years ago when I was covering the legislature, they brought this idea up, and I went around to the committee members who defeated this bill, and it was amazing. A lot of them didn't want to answer, but I finally got them to answer how many kids they had. And we're talking 8, 9, 10 kids in many cases of the members of this committee. I don't think that's the average of the legislature, but, you know, and they all say, you know, this isn't about me personally. This is they say families with lots of kids are struggling financially in a lot of cases. And, you know, that's probably true. Mm. But they do have a lot of kids, folks in the legislature.
Well, this is an interesting topic, and we'll see how this ballot initiative does. First off, if it gets to the ballot, and then how it proceeds. And the voting will happen in November of this year?
Of next year.
Of next
2018.
Year. 2018. Okay, great. Well, Ben Wood, thank you, and we'll look for future reports on this. Just in the next few minutes before we head to our second break, I want to bring government reporter Matthew Piper back into the conversation. Matt, I want to turn now to the lack of resolution over funding for an extension of the Trax line to new terminals under construction at the airport. You reported this early in the week. UTA doesn't have the money to get this done, though it is supposed to be funding this itself, or it had committed to funding this, I guess, itself. Maybe first off, help us understand where this Trax line extension is supposed to go.
So the ideal extension that everyone agrees should be the extension that they go with it would be an elevated track up to the second level, sort of in this parking structure that would be right across the street via Skybridge to a new terminal. So a Skybridge over where you do the pickup and drop-offs on the street below. You'd walk just across that street and you'd be right on at the track station. And it would take you right into Salt Lake City or wherever you want to go. So that everyone agrees that's the way to go. It would be frankly shocking if that isn't the way that they eventually go. But at this current period in time, there's a debate over who should pay for it. In a 2008 agreement, UTA essentially raised its hand and said, we will pay for it. But at that time, they weren't anticipating an elevated track, which is many times more costly or, you know, four times at least more costly than they were expecting. And now they're looking to the city in particular for help. The city, at least the mayor's office, is saying apparently the most recent indication we have from a March internal UTA email is that they were saying not a dime from us. We'll help you find the money, but it's not going to come from us. The city council has a little bit more desire to see, I won't say that. The city council may be a little bit more amenable to pitching in some city funds, but the other alternatives are state or county funding, and then you always, whenever you involve the state, there are people at the city that get a little nervous that the state will try to make a play for control of the airport.
Right. You know, if UTA were to have to pay for this itself, I mean, actually, they've talked about this. They mentioned that they would have to cut services, essentially. That was that's what they're putting out there as a scenario.
Right. There's sort of two doomsday scenarios, I guess, in this first world problem world that we live in is that they would either build a lesser track station where you'd have to walk 1,200 feet. To a ground level station, they could do that for much less with the at about the cost that they were anticipating, or they could cut services elsewhere. And they kind of drew up this scenario that I think was meant to sort of scare Salt Lake City into providing funding, in which they outlined five or six or half dozen bus routes that they would cut to get the $2 million per year that apparently the city had asked for at some point to pay off a bond. That still wouldn't cover it, but it would take five or six routes just to get $2 million a year.
So other than that scenario, which I'm sure a lot of UTA riders would not be happy about and residents, how might this now get financed? What is the agency attempting to do? I mean, a bond, for example, or a tax initiative?
It's a good question. UTA had a Zions Bank draw up a bunch of funding scenarios, And it's pretty much everything under the sun that they've contemplated. They could increase the gas tax. They could use hotel taxes. They could use Salt Lake City parking fees. But they're thinking of a lot of ways to spend other agencies' money. They're good for about $10 million, they figure. So it's got to come from somewhere else. The state, county, and city all have a stake in having the airport tracks connected to the airport and convenient for passengers. So they have a lot of buy-in, theoretically. But right now, it's kind of a stalemate in that no one's stepping up to the plate.
We
had UTA officials in yesterday, talked to the editorial board, and I sat in on that. And they assured us that they are going to get this done. It will be the elevated tracks and station. They are not going to have people go 1,200 feet, even if it's on a people mover, not walking. They said that is not going to happen. But they really had no answers of how it's not going to happen. They just said they're in talks with the city administration. They said that the emails that our story was based on were old, but they didn't really have an update other than to say that they're in talks right now.
When is the overhauled airport or the overhauled terminal, I guess, slated to open, and how soon does this money have to be found for this to coincide with that and to be built, the elevated track that is met?
So part of the UTA's agreement is not only that they'd pay for it, but they'd have this thing running when the new terminal opens in August 2020. And for them to do that, they need to start building it in spring of 2018. So they do need to get to work. They need to find a funding source fast.
Okay. Interesting stuff, Matthew Piper. And there's, I'm sure more coverage of that to come. And more interesting stuff just ahead on the program. But right now, we are going to have to take another quick break. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stick around.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matthew Piper, Dan Harry, Benjamin Wood, and Paul Raleigh. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions during this Friday morning news roundup by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. We are kind of low on time here, but I'd like to quickly get through another story that came out this week before we move on to our underplayed stories. And Matt Piper, it's the ongoing kerfuffle between the city and county over homelessness in the Rio Grande neighborhood and how to address it. There was kind of a parting shot from Salt Lake County Sheriff Jim Winder, who is leaving to go be sheriff of Moab. And actually, before we get there, maybe you could summarize the background of this for us. It has to do with law enforcement, with jail beds, and homelessness. Enforcement of homelessness, I guess, is the way to put it. What's the kind of ongoing context of city and county struggle here?
So for some time, there has been a debate over whether or not the jail... The Salt Lake City, gosh, it's a hard question. Yeah. What's the background to the homelessness problem at Rio Grande? But the Salt Lake City police officers have said, we can't arrest people. And that puts us in a real bind. And they've even said there's times when there's assaults happening, there's violent crimes happening that we cannot put people in jail for. And so how are we meant to get control of this situation?
Why can't they put people in jail?
Because the jail space was limited, and there's a measure afoot. I think it's not quite finalized to open up 300 jail beds elsewhere in the county. Sheriff Jim Winder has always said you can't arrest your way out of this. I think both sides agree on that general principle. But he said, we could have thousands of new jail beds. We're still going to fill them up. And again, I think both sides agree on that principle. But apparently, Sheriff Winder at one point went down. He is kind of tired of these complaints about his overcrowded jail and their inability to do their job because of his jail. And it is sort of a unique arrangement that the county runs the jail and, the Salt Lake City police are responsible for enforcing the law in that area. And so what he said was he went down there at some point and handed out to Salt Lake City police officers this memo telling them how they could override this rule of his and book violent offenders, but also, hey, here's how you can do your job. You know, here's some other alternate ways you can do your job. Right. And among those are, he said, you can seize the drugs and issue a citation, and what's really going to hurt them is not a jail stay, it's those drugs. That's where the money is. And in this kind of parting shot that he took at this Tuesday press conference, he said that the city has not sort of held up its end of the bargain in this collective, that the service providers and the county and the state have all put their chips in, was his term, and that the city is he apparently does not communicate with Chief Mike Brown or Mayor Jackie Poskupski, and that they are not doing the short-term measures needed to improve that situation before homeless resource centers come online in 2019.
Well, some of this sounds a little bit like you know, relationship issues. I'm wondering, with Winder leaving, you know, he's going to Moab to be police chief there, and probably to escape this this sort of turmoil here. Will things change on the ground in the Rio Grande neighborhood, and the relationship between the city and county change as a result of his departure? I don't know, Matt, if that's a question for you, or maybe even Paul Raleigh.
Well, things are going to change on the ground whether he leaves or not. The city is doing some things. They're installing some cameras that they think will reduce the illegal activity in the area, and they'll be able to track license plates of cars who are driving through the area, which they think is a big deal. They've installed some brighter lights. They've put in some new portable toilets. They say these things are going to have a big effect. The county's called for more drastic measures. They've talked about closing the Rio Grande Street in front of the shelter. They've talked about making that street a one-way, as well as 500 West. And both of them would go in the same direction, so you couldn't sort of circle the block.
And this is if you are trying to get drugs in the neighborhood. Is that the idea? I mean, is that the intent of closing down, say, Rio Grande Street?
Right, okay. Correct, yeah. So the county's asking for faster, bigger, and or at least Sheriff Winder in particular was, and the city is from their view, I think, sort of dragging its heels. But the city would say, you know, we're putting a lot of serious thought into this, and we want to be correct before we go forward.
Meanwhile, the county wants more of the state funding pie that has been allocated to this. You talked about actually resource centers coming online soon, but the county's making a bid for additional funding coming their way for things like treatment and counselors and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, everyone needs more treatment dollars. I think the county is asking for 2/3 of state grant money for the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, which is essentially built around the idea that we will not charge people for low-level drug crimes, or we won't incarcerate them. Mm-hmm. Instead, we'll put this money towards treatment and break that cycle. And the county's saying, we've got programs right now that are in place that can best spend that state money that was set aside this year. Previously, it had been sort of doled out via a formula, like a per capita sort of formula. And this year there's an application process, so they're asking for more than their previous share of it.
Is what you're describing right there a sort of extension of what we saw as Operation Diversion, where people were being funneled into meeting with counselors, getting one-on-one treatment options, or the opportunity to go into treatment if they had addiction issues or mental health problems? That's the exact same thing.
Much of it is. And in fact, they would change that program so that there would be this diversion court, sort of like the drug court is for mostly felony cases. This diversion court would be for misdemeanor cases. And the idea is you'd give somebody a charge, and then they would have more incentive to actually stick out the treatment. They had the October sweeps that I think a lot of people probably heard about, where they put a bunch of people in treatment, giving them the option to go to treatment or jail. They had a lot of people abscond from that treatment, and they think now if they have this charge that's issued to them by the court, they'll have more incentive to stick it out and be successful.
I want to turn this over to Paul Raleigh here, the opinion columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Paul, it seems like there's a lot of good intention here, a lot of smart people trying to tackle the problem of homelessness in Rio Grande. There are, of course, though, those relationships that kind of get in the way sometimes. I mean, what's your opinion on this? Are we seeing the beginning of a solution? I don't know.
Well, I think a key part of this discussion that we've just been having is the fact that Jim Winder is not on speaking terms with either the police chief in Salt Lake City or Mayor Jackie Biskupski. She's really not on speaking terms with Ben McAdams, the county mayor. And I don't see this. This is something that the city and the county have to collaborate on, and figure out, you know, how they're going to tackle some of these issues. And when the mayor's not even talking to people, and the police chief's not even talking to the sheriff, I don't see how you're going to get anything done solve any problems. I mean, I was just talking about this off when we were off the air. Does Jackie Biskupski get along with anybody? She seems to be feuding. We're having stories all the time with Jackie Biskupski's feud with somebody else, whether it's the county mayor or the county sheriff or the county council or the UTA. So I think that's a big problem that we need to look at more.
Guys, I'm sorry to say that we could tackle more of the stories that were from this past week, but we do need to now turn to our underplayed stories of the week, the final segment of the show. And, you know, Paul Raleigh, if you're ready with an underplayed story, I'll begin with you there.
Okay. we had a story in today's paper by Kelly Gifford saying that, you know, this uncertainty with what is going to happen with healthcare reform and everything else, and the fact that they might not be able to use, you know, subsidies that were set aside for low-income people and that sort of thing, could increase premiums for Utahns by up to 15% this next year. And this problem that, you know, the uncertainty with healthcare and everything else, it could very seriously affect Utahns in the next year or two.
Okay. That's an interesting underplayed story. You can check it out at sltrip.com. Matt Piper, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, it looks like Donald Trump may have saved a life here with his Covfefe tweet. The Utah Humane Society, or the Humane Society of Utah, I'm sorry, has an 11-year-old male brown tabby that they have renamed Covfefe. I think they're still looking for Covfefe is still looking for a new owner and lifelong friend. I think that was some wise social media strategy
to name your cat Covfefe after the misspelling of I'm not certain what that
coverage. I think. But anyway, go down there, pick up Covfefe. If Covfefe is no longer available, other cats are all pretty much the same. If you don't, then my wife will pick him up, and we'll have four cats in our 900 square foot apartment.
Help out the Pipers with a pet adoption. Covfefe at the Humane Society of Utah. Dan Harry, your underplayed story of the week.
I am going to cite Christopher Smart's story in the Tribune today about the beginning of the intertribal gathering in Bears Ears, and hundreds of tribal members from the Navajo, the Mountain Utes, the Northern Utes, the Goshutes, the Hopis, and the Zunis will be there. And it could be that they're having this gathering, which runs through Sunday, at the same time we hear the announcement about the recommendation of the future of the Bears Ears. If that happens, you will see some very upset tribal members, because they are the biggest supporters of that monument continuing as it is.
We are expecting soon to hear.
Well, we'd heard that it was going to happen this weekend, maybe even as early as today. But my guess is that when they hear that this intertribal gathering is occurring, they probably would maybe rethink that. Although Saturday morning, remember, is prime Trump tweet time.
Right. Well, so, and Friday is the day that news comes out that you don't want anybody to hear, necessarily. Apparently, that's what I'm told. Ben Wood, your underplayed story of the week. I'm ready for it.
Yes, David Buehler, the state's commissioner of higher education, he stopped by the Tribune offices this week to kind of describe the timeline for replacing David Pershing as president of the University of Utah. So we have a story from my colleague Alex Stuckey. It describes a minimum 8 months, more like a year, before there's a new president at the U. But despite all the recent drama with health sciences and Huntsman cancer, Commissioner Buehler is confident that there will be many candidates anxious to work at the University of Utah.
I would imagine he's probably right. Okay, I will, and a year-long process.
Yeah, 8 to 12 months, but probably more on the side of 12.
Okay, thanks, Ben Wood. For my own part, underplayed story of the week, I'm going to go with news reported by Emma Penrod that the EPA is giving Utah and other states a pass, or at least more time when it comes to complying with ozone pollution standards. Apparently, a release from the EPA said that part of the reasoning behind this was that the new head of the agency, Scott Pruitt, wants to give states greater flexibility in this. You can read the full thing and all of these other underplayed stories we've been talking about at sltrib.com. But Dan Harry, Benjamin Wood, Matt Piper, Paul Raleigh, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW. Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen manage the broadcast at Utah Public Radio. And thanks very much, as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means. For podcasts of this program, you can visit our website, kcpw.org, or you can download the show using whatever platform you use to get your podcasts. Find us on Facebook. We are at KCPW-FM. On Twitter, we are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Be sure to join us again next week. Thanks once again to tuning in to Behind the Headlines, and have a great weekend.